It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Their work is part performance art, part civil disobedience, part documentary filmmaking, and part satire. The Yes Men have been engaging in their guerrilla activism since the mid-90s. They've made three films together. The most recent is The Yes Men Are Revolting, and that film will be screening in Iowa City at Film Scene this afternoon at 3 p.m., followed by a Q&A. They'll be speaking tonight at the Iowa Memorial Union as part of the University of Iowa's lecture series at 7:30, and they are with me now, Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Charity.
Hello, hi. Mike. You both said hi at the same time. I'll try to remember which one's which. So I know you've told your origin story a million times, but tell us again. You got together in the mid-90s and you put together a website. Tell me what your goal was.
Well, we put together a website that looked like the World Trade Organization's website, but it was meant to be funny. We were trying to make fun of an organization that at the time was really forcing a pretty aggressive trade policy on the world. And there were a lot of activists going to Seattle for the famous, now famous, battle in Seattle. And we couldn't go. So we put up a fake website that looked like the WTO's, and it was funny. But a lot of people didn't really read it. They simply went and asked us questions and eventually asked us to attend their conferences, which we did.
All right. So when people started sending you emails, you answered as the World Trade Organization.
That's right.
All right. And then you got invited. Did you get invited to actually speak at a conference?
Well, they wanted the director general of the WTO, but he obviously couldn't go because we didn't know him and we didn't really want him to go anyways. We wanted we didn't know what we wanted. It took us about 3 months to decide finally to write back and say we would go, that we would send a substitute, that the assistant to Michael Moore, who was the director general, would go. It took us 3 months to realize we could do that.
All right. And I mean, that's really where the Yes Men came from. When you decided that, yeah, we'll go to that conference, we'll do this, what did you think you were going to do?
Well, we thought we would deliver a talk that was intensely satirical and would make so much lethal fun of the WTO and its corporate-friendly trade policies that people would just get it and, you know, it would be very funny and very powerful and they would change their minds or get very angry and chase us out of the room. And in case that happened, we had a camera. We brought somebody who filmed the whole thing. Instead, there was absolutely no reaction whatsoever. People just applauded, asked polite questions. And we had made a really very disturbing talk in which we talked about how we had to basically privatize democracy and allow corporations to buy votes directly from citizens instead of funding the whole campaign nonsense, which is very wasteful. Just let them buy the votes directly instead of this whole nonsense, you know, where they fund all these candidates.
So you thought you were really out there.
Yeah.
And the audience?
They accepted it. They politely applauded, asked for business cards, and at the luncheon afterward were incredibly respectful. And it disturbed us so much that we decided that we should make a movie about this. And that launched into impersonation after impersonation of the WTO at these conferences and business meetings. And every time we tried to up the ante a little bit.
So once that film came out, and I know that it was a big hit with a lot of people. I'm sure it wasn't a hit with anybody who went to those conferences. But what was the result? I mean, what were you hoping the result would be, and what happened?
Well, people liked it. People laughed. And that's one of the things we hoped. We also hoped that people might find out about what's wrong with this system that we're a part of, that we're still a part of course, the system that privileges money over people and says that if the rich are allowed to do whatever they want, things will turn out well for everybody. And that's a nonsense that's been promoted very heavily for the last 45 years or so, since the 70s. And it's simply false. And we hope that we could inject some humor into that and use humor as a way of getting that across to people.
So you made people laugh. Do you think that you spurred anybody into action?
Well, we might not have spurred anybody into action, but we contributed to a movement that actually won. You know, and the WTO was stopped in its tracks in 2001 and then in 2003. And over time, you know, a band of countries, actually the what they call the least developed countries, formed a bloc that successfully stopped the WTO from implementing all of those trade policies that were hurting them. And that was largely because there were so many people in the streets at that time. That was, you know, right around 2001.
Yeah. We think of what we do as useful within a big movement. No action in itself has any kind of success, not even remotely. They're drops in the bucket. But combined, they win. And, you know, you see across time movements do win. Like, we don't have slavery anymore, or, you know, 15-hour workdays or child labor or all these things that we used to have. And why? Because people in movements took action.
Once the movie came out and it became impractical for you to impersonate people from the World Trade Organization at that point, what did you think about your future? How did you decide what to do next?
Well, it decided for us. We were approached after our movie came out by somebody involved with the Bhopal struggle, the struggle to hold the Dow Chemical Corporation accountable for the Bhopal catastrophe.
Okay. And for people who aren't familiar, the Bhopal catastrophe was the biggest industrial disaster in 1984. Poisonous gases leaked and the death toll is
tens of thousands.
Right, yeah. Right. At least 18,000 at this point. And of course, it's all very, very muddy. So Dow Chemical takes over Union Carbide, and that's kind of where you came in.
Yeah. This person suggested we try to do something funny around that. So we set up a fake website. That's what we knew how to do. It's not very funny.
It's not a funny subject.
No. But we figured we could use humor with that as well. I mean, we were, you know, we, like everybody, were completely outraged about this. And we thought, well, we'll just translate that into satire. I mean, there's a lot of outrageous subjects that can be translated into satire, like, you know, Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, proposing eating the children as a way to cure the hunger that arose out of trade inequities in England in the 19th century. So this, you know, why not the Bhopal catastrophe and Dow's refusal of accountability? So we set up a fake website. Satirical Dow website, looked like the real thing, and got a little bit of attention for that. But then 2 years later, the BBC stumbled onto it and accidentally invited us to speak.
Well, joining us live from Paris now is Jude Finisterre. He's a spokesman for Dow Chemicals, which took over Union Carbide. Good morning to you. A day of commemoration in Bhopal. Do you now accept responsibility for what happened?
Steve, yes. Today is a great day for all of us at Dow, and I think for millions of people around the world as well. It's 20 years since the disaster, and today I'm very, very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives, and to fully and swiftly remediate the Bhopal plant site. Now, when we acquired Union Carbide 3 years ago, we knew what we were getting, and it's worth $12 billion. $12 billion. We have resolved to liquidate Union Carbide, this nightmare for the world and this headache for Dow, and use the $12 billion to provide more than $500 per victim, which is all that they've seen, a maximum of just about $500 per victim. It is not plenty good for an Indian, as one of our spokespersons unfortunately said a couple of years ago. In fact, it pays for 1 year of medical care. We will adequately compensate the victims.
So that was obviously a huge coup for you. And watching the clip is uncomfortable. there were results, I mean, direct results of that. And one of the results, of course, was that Dow Chemical's stock took a huge dive. I can imagine that there were other consequences as well. I'm sure that there were people watching who had lost someone in the Bhopal disaster who thought, oh, at last, finally. Or the producer who booked you. I'm sure there were consequences there as well. Does that worry you when you, I mean, that was, I'm sure, a pretty amazing moment for you. Do you also worry about the
It definitely worried
other
us
people and who might get hurt?
Yeah. We worried about and considered all the different options that there were for collateral damage. And
right.
But in the end, we decided to go ahead with it anyway. And we went ahead with it anyway with the advice of, you know, people who'd been working on the issue for a long time, and who ultimately felt that it was much more important to have the Bhopal catastrophe remembered and to have it come up in the news in that way, especially in the United States, rather than have that anniversary of the disaster go by without people really noticing. And, you know, the gamble worked. And in the end, the Bhopal victims were really glad that it had happened. There were a few activists who heard from a BBC reporter about it at the time and initially cried tears of joy. But we have a lot of assumptions about how what that's supposed to mean for people, that they would be then gravely disappointed to find out it's not true. But actually, we found that our assumption was wrong and that they weren't disappointed. They actually were grateful that they had a moment where that they believed that where they had the feeling they knew they never were going to have.
Especially because it resulted in so much press, too. There were 600 articles in the U.S. press about the disaster, about the 20th anniversary. That wouldn't have happened otherwise. And they had to tell the story of Dow buying Union Carbide and all that. So it resulted in information, and the victims, the activists in Bhopal, were very happy.
I'm talking with Mike Bonanno and Andy Bickelbaum, better known as the Yes Men. They'll be speaking tonight in Iowa City as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series. Their talk is titled Making Meaningful Mischief with the Yes Men. It's tonight at 7:30 at the Iowa Memorial Union. And their newest film, The Yes Men Are Revolting, will show this afternoon at 3 p.m. at Film Scene in Iowa City. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll get a preview.
Who are you really, sir?
Do you have a business card? Are you with the U.S. Chamber?
I do.
Can I see your business card?
Can I see yours?
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk to author J. Ryan Straddle about his debut novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest. But with me right now are the Yes Men, Mike Bonanno and Andy Bickelbaum. For about 20 years, they've been pulling pranks, making documentary films, and trying to spark social change. Their latest film is called The Yes Men Are Revolting. It's showing this afternoon in Iowa City at Film Scene at 3 p.m., followed by a Q&A. They'll also be speaking tonight at the Iowa Memorial Union in Iowa City as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series. And I want to talk about your most recent film, The Yes Men Are Revolting. Your theme in this film is climate change. Who's your target?
This latest film is more addressed to the people who can actually make change, which is all of us. You know, previous films may have been about the target and the corporations that do bad things. And this, too, there are targets. I mean, there are very clearly identifiable people who do bad things, and we do things against them. But the main target, the main object of the film is to appeal to the people who can make change and social movements. And in a way, the Occupy movement is sort of the hero of the film, and that's where the whole thing pivots. So
I want to play a clip from this film. This is you are giving a press conference at the National Press Club as a representative of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So we'll listen to that.
Dave Farrenbaum from the Washington Post. Is there a sense from you guys that this is an inevitable thing and so you should get in to try to make...
Okay, I'm Eric Wolfslagle. I'm with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not an official U.S. Chamber of Commerce event. I don't know what pretenses you're here,
but this is a fraudulent press activity and a stunt.
Who are you really, sir?
Do you have a business card? Are you with the U.S. Chamber?
I do.
Can I see your business card?
Can I see yours?
Are you here representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I work there, and you do not look familiar to me at all.
Because I see your business card.
Is this
card.
A stunt?
Are you interrupting a press?
Yes, I am. This guy does not represent the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Can we finish the interview?
No.
If you would like to have a press conference, you can have your own press conference.
What is your position?
I just spoke my position.
What is your official title with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
I'm the assistant to Mr. Donahue.
Okay. This guy is a fraud. He's lying. This is, a stunt that I've never seen before. So if you'd like to actually talk to the legitimate Chamber of Commerce, I've got my business cards outside. This gentleman, I will assure you, does not have any business cards, and he's not legitimate.
All right. That's a moment from your most recent film, The Yes Men Are Revolting. And you're caught in that moment. What what did that feel like?
Exciting. It was sort of, a real bit of luck that guy barged in. That was the head of public relations for the Chamber of Commerce, who strangely decided that the best thing to do would be to interrupt our press conference full of journalists and, call me out. Very strange decision, because that meant that we had this wonderful video footage of this guy barging in, and it became a much bigger news story because of that. It was in heavy rotation on all the networks for a day, and Al Gore even referred to it 2 weeks later, and when the chamber actually reversed its position on the climate bill that this was all about. So, and I kind of knew that as it was happening. Like, this is amazing. It was also unnerving and disturbing, and the adrenaline flows.
Were you trying to keep him going?
Yeah.
At that point, you just wanted to. Yeah. We're rolling tape. We know that we've got gold here.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think on a certain level I was having fun with it, even though it was extremely excruciatingly nerve-wracking. But that can be really fun. People do all kinds of things to stimulate their nerves.
In the most recent movie, you share more about yourselves. I mean, there are some personal vignettes in the movie. And you guys have been, a little bit shadowy in the past. Was that a difficult decision to open up more about yourselves and your own stories?
It's hard to do, but it wasn't a difficult decision, in that we really wanted to make a movie that was different than our last two movies, and we wanted to make a movie where we could identify more with people, with the audience. People could imagine themselves in our shoes. We're not some kind of superhero with special skills and talents. We just have decided to do this. And, to make that clear, and to make it clear that we're kind of all in it together, it seemed more important to be more vulnerable and to show our regular daily lives. And it makes for a better movie. I mean, the critics have basically said that this movie's our best one. So, I choose to believe them, because maybe more people go see it.
It's also, we also chose to show our disappointments and our failures, and how and we actually get kind of despondent at certain points in the movie as we go along, and we think, oh, what good is this doing? Nothing has changed. And it's only when Occupy Wall Street bursts on the scene that we realize that this actually does make sense, that there is some momentum, and that being part of that movement is what, matters. And that's why everything that we've been doing is not a failure, even though the individual actions didn't seem like they succeeded. And that's kind of always the way it is with activism. The individual actions never achieve what they set out to, but cumulatively they all do. So that's the kind of the main message of the film. And we had to show our torment in order to make that stand out.
It seems like you have to operate on a number of different levels. As you're doing a stunt, as you're making a film, as you're advocating for change, you're doing all of these things, and the film gets shaped sort of after the fact. You have to figure out where that's going while you're making it.
To some degree, we have used filmmaking as a way of structuring our lives. the stories that we tell, which action we decide to do next sometimes is about how it fits into the narrative of the film. And, the same can be said for how we go about our daily lives. Since it's a doc, it's sort of all consuming. And in some ways, it's hard to tell where the documentary begins and the fiction of your own life you know, ends. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, it's all sort of a storytelling, constructive process throughout.
You know, I think I've read that, Mike, one of your early projects was with the Barbie Liberation Organization. This is back before the Yes Men.
Yeah, more than 20 years ago.
Right. So, and you and others took Barbies and G.I. Joes and changed their voice boxes and then planted them in stores so that the Barbies would say very non-stereotypical Barbie things.
Yeah, they said things like, dead men tell no lies, and they made gun noises. And then G.I. Joes, their counterpart, said things like, I love to shop with you. And so, yeah, then we put them on store shelves. People brought them home for Christmas. And on Christmas Day, there was a big surprise that ended up in, you know, on the news all over, right, all over the world, actually.
So 20 some odd years later, you were talking about the big picture and seeing change. Target decides to no longer have a pink aisle and a blue aisle. Do you feel like you were at the forefront of that movement?
Wow. I mean, when you put it in the context of that kind of triumph, it feels sort of pathetic. But but there are so many huge advances that have been made by different movements that have been pressuring, you know, to see gender equality. And I mean, and there's still a long way to go, but, you know, there's definitely been a change. I mean, if you look at gay rights, for example, it's like massive, you know, people get married now. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. So there's definitely advances. And yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why this film is different and it's personal is that we do look back at, you know, 20, 25 years of being adults, and we can see the change that's happened, and we can see where it's really made a difference to be a part of a social movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's next?
Well, we've started a kind of online workshop training series. You can go to actionswitchboard.net, and you can post ideas that you have there, get help carrying them out, and we're also doing 8-week training sessions online. So, 'cause we've been for quite a while now already working with activist groups to help them carry out projects that matter to them, around issues that matter, and that's been working. You know, a number of our in quotes recent projects are actually other people's projects that we just participate in. Like the Chamber of Commerce thing was actually the idea of a group of young people in Washington called the Avaaz Action Factory, who had the entire idea. They just needed our help.
Yes, man.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, helping them figure it out. And I was the oldest one. So that was actually the main reason that I did it rather than one of them. So we're just doing more of that.
We're also at a really critical moment with climate change. Obviously, you know, we may have passed the tipping point, but that's not a reason not to fight. And, you know, coming up in December of this year, there's a big meeting in Paris, big UN meeting, and it's another chance between now and then to try to get that on the agenda as much as possible. And so we're trying to recruit as many people to work on that issue as possible.
Are you going to be there?
Well, probably. We'll probably be in Paris. I mean, right now, what we concentrate on is creating sustained action throughout the rest of the year. There's so many people focusing on Paris that we feel like we also need to just make sure that we keep momentum going before and after. And so, yeah, we'll probably be there, though.
All right.
Well, I don't want to give away any secrets.
Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mike Bonanno and Andy Bickelbaum, they're better known as the Yes Men. They'll be speaking in Iowa City tonight as part of the University of Iowa's lecture series. Their talk is called Making Meaningful Mischief with the Yes Men. Their latest film, The Yes Men Are Revolting, will show this afternoon at 3 p.m. at Film Scene in Iowa City. They'll also be there for a Q&A following the film. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. J. Ryan Strottle lives in Los Angeles, but he grew up in Minnesota, and his debut novel not only tells the story of a Midwestern family, but of Midwestern food, including both high cuisine and comfort food. The book is Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It came out in June and quickly made its way to the New York Times bestseller list, and J. Ryan Strottle is here with me today. Hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
That's my pleasure.
Now, you start the book with one of the most iconic and maybe one of the most reviled foods of Midwestern culture. I don't know. Perhaps you can just start by sharing a little bit from the beginning of the book with us.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let me actually hit that one on the nose.
All right.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. On a December afternoon in 1971... Dorothy Seaborg of Duluth, Minnesota, fell on the ice and broke her hip while walking to her mailbox, disrupting the supply line of lutefisk for the Sunday Advent dinners in St. Olaf's Lutheran Church. Gustav Torvald of Duluth's Gustav & Sons Bakery, and one of the most conspicuous Norwegians between Cloquet and Two Harbors, had promised everyone in St. Olaf's Fellowship Hall that there would be no break in lutefisk continuity. His family would step in and carry on the brutal Scandinavian tradition for the benefit of the entire Twin Ports region. Never mind that neither Gustav, his wife Aline, nor his children had ever even seen a live whitefish before, much less caught one, pounded it, dried it, soaked it in lye, re-soaked in cold water, or done the careful cooking required to make something that, when perfectly prepared, looks like jellied smog and smells like boiled aquarium water. How's that?
Perfect. That's J. Ryan Strottle reading from his novel Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And that's where one of the main characters of the book really gets his start in food. He is one of the children of this family, Lars, and he takes on the responsibility of preparing lutefisk.
Yes. And it has terrifying social implications for him. But it does... ineluctably lead to his marriage and ultimately his fatherhood, which is the, which becomes the purpose of, his purpose for living and the focal point of love in his life.
Right. Although he does blame lutefisk for having never had a date in high school.
That's right.
Because
that's
he always smelled like lutefisk. But he goes on to start working in restaurants in the Twin Cities and working his way up, learning all different kinds of cuisines. He has a very good palate, and he falls in love with a woman with an exceptional palate.
Right. A woman named Cynthia, who is an aspiring sommelier, and spoiler alert, does eventually become a sommelier. And the two have a child, and I think it's it's perhaps inevitable that the child would be into food as well, or have a talent for it, or an inclination for it, and indeed she does.
Now Right. We'll talk more about her, Eva, who really is the focal point of the novel in a few minutes. But you did grow up in Minnesota, Hastings, Minnesota?
That's correct.
And this book takes place in the Midwest. It is largely about people who just really don't fit into whatever the norm is in their community, in their various Iowa or Minnesotan communities. Mm-hmm. Was that how you felt when you were growing up?
Oh, sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I absolutely love the Midwest and I enjoy coming back. In fact, I'll be back for the Minnesota State Fair this summer. But growing up as kind of a kid who didn't love hockey. I watch it now, but growing up, I didn't play it. I didn't watch it. And in my particular hometown, that was a choice to be alienated, I think, if you weren't into hockey. I didn't love cheese and soup. I made certain choices that set me apart. Wasn't into winter sports. Not that talented an athlete anyway. I mean, it's basically, a little nerd, like a lot of nerds at anywhere. It doesn't matter where you are. You feel a little alienated. But that said, I think the Midwest was a wonderful place to grow up, and I definitely got I feel like I got a taste of everything. At one point, I had a character say, this character didn't make the book, Anything that's any good will end up in Iowa. You know, I don't have to leave Iowa. If it's any good, it'll come here eventually.
that should be our new state motto.
Right. And even though that character didn't make the book, I felt like that a lot growing up. I felt like, even before the internet, I felt like, I can get music, I can get movies, the kind of culture I identified with. I did grow up feeling like I was part of a larger world, like my character Eva does. And so I developed interests in things that had nothing to do with the Midwest. Like Eva grows chocolate habanero peppers, which...
Not a traditional Midwestern food.
No.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we will talk more about J. Ryan Straddle's new novel. It's called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It tells the story of a Midwestern family and of Midwestern food, both high cuisine and comfort food. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is J. Ryan Straddle. His debut novel is Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It came out in June. It's already on the New York Times bestseller list. J. Ryan Straddle grew up in Minnesota, although he lives in Los Angeles now. And in this book, there is a lot of food, as the title implies. And you were talking a little earlier. You introduced your character, Eva. And Lars is the man who grew up making lutefisk. He falls in love with a woman named Cynthia. They have a daughter named Eva, who very sadly grows up without her parents, although she does seem to have inherited their gifts. As you crafted that character, we talked about people who just don't fit in. Where did Eva come from?
Wow, Eva has a few influences. starting with her based a little bit on my own alienation, like I implied earlier, but she's also based on a couple of chefs that I've met over the years, including one who I went to high school with, a woman named Amy Kovacs, Amy Schabert originally, but I met her in high school, and she's now a very successful baker in Minneapolis. There's another woman named Patty Clark who I met when I was 20. I've known her for about 20 years, and she's a professional chef in New York. And seeing these women take this profession on and develop their skills and expand them, and just their attitude and their generosity was really inspiring to me. In telling the story of Eva, I wanted to tell the story of someone who became successful without screwing people over, without the emotional without the kind of toll that you see in a lot of narratives about, successful men in particular, thinking about movies like There Will Be Blood or, we seem very satisfied with the idea that, to be successful, you've got to, stomp people over to get to the top and you've got to leave a trail of disappointment and heartbreak behind you. And no, Eva doesn't do that. And I really wanted to write that story.
It's interesting. I mean, that sounds, I'm sure some people are thinking, oh, Midwestern nice, Minnesota nice, Iowa nice. But this is not a book where everyone behaves well. There's a lot of misbehavior in the book. I mean, starting with Eva's mother, who very early on abandons her daughter, just leaves to pursue her own career and her own ambitions. Were you concerned at all about steering away from some of the Midwestern stereotypes that people have?
Well, I wanted to address them, because they're very prevalent in our culture. But I also wanted to show kinds of Midwesterners I grew up with and their complexity. I grew up in a deer hunting family. And I really wanted to have a character that was an enthusiastic deer hunter whose relationship to food, whose passion for food is completely oriented around hunting season. Like otherwise, he's a person that doesn't have any care or involvement, or food conscience per se. Like he eats for convenience and pleasure. But when he's hunting, it's a life-giving force for him. And he orients his year around it. It's the most significant weekend of the year, the opening of hunting season. And I don't always see characters like that captured you know, as fully rounding characters. So, you know, one of my characters is an attempt to do that. I have other characters that are, you know, like a Division I softball player at Northwestern, you know, on the worst day of her life. you know, I've got a fashionable foodie goddess in Minneapolis who's dealing with a lot of, let's call it self-imposed obstacles.
Sure.
Yeah. And then, of course, Pat Prager, who is my Lutheran church basement lady. You know, that's a familiar Midwestern trope, but I've given her some things to deal with that you wouldn't always see in a book about someone like her. So, yeah, in essence, I've taken probably a combination of, or a conflation of people I've known in life and Midwestern types and made their lives really difficult, you know, put them in situations where they're going to be challenged and their personalities are going to have to expand.
Will you read a little bit from the book for us again and introduce us to Eva as we find her in your book? And of course, we see her grow up. And I believe at the end of the book, she's about, 26 or 27 years old. So we see her from infancy through her upper 20s. And at what point are you going to introduce her to us?
I'll introduce her when she's 11. It's the one chapter of the book told from her point of view. It's a very key point in her life where I think she realizes, you know, what's at stake for her, and she realizes what, you know, what her direction in life is going to be and how she's going to conduct herself. And this is a scene where she's just finished spiking the birthday desserts for her fourth grade class with chocolate habanero pepper powder that has a Scoville rating of close to 1,000. So she's basically
to set their mouths on fire is her goal.
She's going to set the mouths on fire of her fellow fourth graders who have been picking on her all year. She's just finished doing that at this point. When she was done, a little before midnight, she licked the cinnamon and sugar in her chocolate habanero pepper powder off of her fingers all at once, feeling the severe, pleasant burning on her lips and mouth. She was pretty sure that in her 3-plus years of handling and eating extremely hot peppers, she had exhausted most of the substance P from the soft tissues in her mouth and hands, which didn't replenish even as she got older. The main reason she began growing increasingly hot, exotic peppers was to find something with enough capsaicin to release the endorphins. It became more and more inaccessible with increased heat intolerance. She wanted to feel lava blossoming in her eyes and nose and mouth again, like the first time she ate a regular habanero with Cousin Randy, back when he was still allowed to babysit her. She cleaned out her last teaspoon of chili powder in the jar with a wet finger, put it on her tongue, and let the graceless heat savage her soft tissues as she lay on her bed, closed her eyes, felt the angels in her blood begin to sing, and officially turned 11.
That's J. Ryan Straddle reading from Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And as Eva grows and survives all of the trials of being a teenager, she finds a world that she feels like she can be a part of. She goes out on a date, and when she's out on the date at a nice restaurant, because this boy is trying very hard to impress her, she starts analyzing what she's eating and makes a connection with the chef, who's amazed that this young girl can pick out all of the different flavors in this fish that he's prepared. And she really gets into the restaurant community, and she's described as having a once-in-a-generation palate. Are you yourself a foodie?
I think I'm a food enthusiast. I sometimes describe myself as an enthusiastic end user. I cook a little bit, but I'm a much more passionate eater than I am creator of food. I follow recipes. I don't write them.
Although you do include a number of recipes in the book, and they really run the gamut from, as I mentioned, the Midwestern comfort foods to sort of, there aren't very many recipes for high cuisine, but we get it described a lot.
Yeah. And many of the recipes are based on recipes from my great-grandmother's Lutheran Church cookbook out of Hunter, North Dakota. So they're old, you know, decades proven Upper Midwestern recipes for things like bars and chicken wild rice hot dish.
Well, you kind of seem to straddle this line in the book between this mind-blowing food that Eva and some of her friends can prepare, although she is the superstar in this book. And she rises, I don't want to spoil the story, but she rises to this incredible level where people will pay $5,000 for her to prepare a meal for them. But at the same time, you describe a scene in which Eva and the people who prepare these meals with her, everybody else has had this mind-blowing experience, and she and her friends and this assembled family that she's kind of created for herself, they're eating macaroni and cheese and drinking beer, which seems like a bit of a send-up of the foodie culture at the same time as it's kind of celebrating it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that's actually based on the chefs I've met who will make the most elaborate meals for other people, but then at the end of the day, just make something really simple and comforting for themselves. But it's also a nod to Eva's background and upbringing. You know, she grew up in the world of bars and hot dish, and I think that's kind of where her heart lies. Like, I think someone can exist in both worlds. I don't think that the continued dilation of locavorism, you know, and conscience as it relates to food preparation and agriculture has to preclude some of the wonderful old dishes a lot of us grew up with in the Midwest. And I really wanted Eva to straddle both worlds.
And you live in Los Angeles, where, of course, the foodie culture is at a pinnacle. And do you find yourself torn between enjoying that kind of culture and some of the amazing dishes that you can have and then also thinking, what are we doing?
Oh, yeah. Well, to me, some of the best comfort food in L.A. is Mexican food. I mean, you can get like nouveau, healthy, hipster Mexican food as well, but the traditional Mexican food is absolutely wonderful. And to me, it's kind of, for me personally, it's a little bit of an analog to, you know, the Midwestern food I grew up with in terms of flavor, calorie count, you know, combinations of meat and dairy in one dish. So, I've found myself quite fond of that. But, you know, when I wrote the book, I thought, okay, this is a little ridiculous. $5,000 for a pop-up dinner. You know, it's in a varying location every year. Now it almost reads like historical fiction.
Right.
Yeah, I felt at the time I wrote the book, 2 years ago, that, oh, yeah, this is a ways off. Like, this is a little beyond the pale.
Right. So outlandish that it feels like fiction.
But no, I've since heard of places, you know, that have similar prices, you know, not quite that high, but it'll get there. You know, roving locations. You know, there are pop-up meals and supper clubs not dissimilar from Eva's. You know, Eva's would be considered on the high end of what now exists, but it wouldn't be beyond the pale. And at the time I thought, oh no, this isn't going to happen anytime soon.
So food is a very important recurring theme in the book. It's something that brings people together. It's something that gives people an opportunity to express themselves creatively and an opportunity to learn and better themselves. Another recurring theme of the novel, though, is loss. And I'm curious because the novel, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like a tragedy because there's a lot of tragedy in it, but it's also a fun read. It's quite lighthearted. And I almost felt conflicted because of all of the loss in the book, having that sort of lighthearted feeling to take away from it. Where does that come from for you?
For me, I think the loss in the book is inspired in large part by the loss of my own mom about 10 years ago. She was a huge influence on me as a person and a writer, and I wish she had lived to see this book because I felt like when I sat down to write this book, I felt like I wrote the book that I would want her to like. You know, I wrote the book she would have loved if she had lived to see it in some ways. And I felt that she was very much on my shoulder and behind me in a way, communicating with me while I was writing this book. I often would pause and think, oh, what would my mom say in this situation? What would she have this character say? What would she think about this character's choice? And so, in a way, I feel like it was co-written with her. And writing this book, in a way, was an extension of my mourning process. I know she died 10 years ago, but if you've lost a parent or a child, you know, like, that's a loss that never, you know, I don't think ever leaves you. And I had never written about it before. I'd never explicitly or implicitly written about my mom's death, and it came out in this book quite a bit. In the Midwestern setting, I felt like it was inevitable. And so I just took it on head on. I just said, you know what, if this is what the undercurrent of the book is, I'm going to pull it up. You know, it's going to be at the forefront, and I'm going to have characters confront the kind of loss I've confronted, and I'm going to write directly from the emotions I experienced and am experiencing.
Your characters feel these losses for many, many years and in many different ways. And you don't focus so much on the immediate mourning, but on that empty place that's left in their lives as time goes on.
Yeah, very insightful, yes. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the characters use food as a method to connect with people to fill that empty space. Like Pat Prager, for example, refers to her bars as like love freely given. You know, this is her offering to the world. This is how she connects with people. This is how she expresses her love for people. And, you know, I think characters like even Octavia, you know, the foodie goddess of the Minneapolis Supper Club scene, you know, she's trying to impress people. She's trying to, you know, win a boyfriend. She's trying to impress her friends. You know, it's such a... you know, food becomes such a device for connection, you know, either wholesomely or calculatedly in this book. And a lot of it is, yeah, as you implied, to fill a gap created by a loss.
And you've mentioned Pat Prager a couple of times. She makes these peanut butter bars that win at county fairs and are to die for. And I was surprised that after all of the amazing meals that you described, that was the thing that I was left craving.
That's wonderful, yeah. And I think Eva would agree with you. That's why it's the dessert at the end of her extremely fancy meal, are these extremely traditional Midwestern peanut butter bars. Yeah.
Hard to beat.
Yeah.
Well, J. Ryan Straddle, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's such a pleasure.
J. Ryan Straddle, his debut novel is Kitchens of the Great Midwest. He lives in Los Angeles now, but he grew up in Minnesota, and the book tells the story of a Midwestern family and of Midwestern food. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. We love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about memory and how it shapes us. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.